Now I will tell you, Buster, that I ain't a fan of custards.
Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Craig Johnson. He is the author of that fantastic Longmire series, and he's out with his 16th novel. This one's called Next to Last Stand. The book's available now wherever you find books are sold, and this is also the basis for the Netflix series Longmire. Craig, this book is unlike the Longmires that we the Longmire novels that we've gotten used to. The last.
It's a little bit different from some of the others, I have to admit. I'm always puzzled by that question of where fine books are sold. I mean, is there a place you go where crappy books are sold? Is that a different kind of store or what?
That's a good point. You know, I've never known a crappy bookstore, but
maybe I need to open one of those up. It might be a chain that I could look into. Yeah, this is a different kind of book. That's kind of the name of the game for me, I have to admit. Whenever you're, approachable, this is like the 16th book in the Walt Longmire series, with two novellas and a collection of short stories. And I think, one of the responsibilities you've got, whenever you're writing a series of books, I mean, we've all, started series of books that start out gangbusters, but then you get a couple of books in and it seems like, they've kind of got a formula or, they're kind of doing the same things over and over again. The characters don't seem to be evolving or changing, and I think that's a difficult situation to be in, not only because it bores the reader, but also because it bores the author. It seems to me that, if you're trying to do that kind of a formula book, it would get really tiresome after a while. And so, I don't know, for me, it's kind of like being a gambler at the horse track. You're looking at the horses the same way that you look at storylines. And you look at each one and think, okay, is that one going to be able to go the distance? Is that going to be a different kind of story than anything that I've done before? And I think that's one of the challenges, something that, you kind of owe to the reader.
Well, this involves an art heist, and I thought it was interesting because it's not something that you would think that Sheriff Walt Longmire would be involved in. It kind of reminded me of Sheriff Joe in Arizona with the Obama birth certificate things. Why in the hell is a sheriff involved in this particular thing? So tell me about this art heist, because it's centered around the Custer's Last Fight painting that I think so many of us have seen and probably don't realize we've seen it.
Right. It doesn't compare that much fiction to it. For me, a lot of it, had to come from just the fact that if you wander into every single, saloon and bar and restaurant here in the American West, you're going to see Cassely Adams' Custer's Last Fight. You're just going to see it everywhere. It's been referred to as the most viewed by questionably inebriated art critics than any other form of American artwork. It started out about 10 years after, it's just a brief, art history lesson here to go along with it, but it was about 10 years after the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, that Cassely Adams, a very little-known author, or rather little-known artist in St. Louis, did this painting. And, as with what usually happened with these paintings at that period in time was they would take them on tour, and people would pay 25 cents, to go into a wagon and see the painting. And so it went on tour and came back to St. Louis, and they weren't quite sure what to do with it. It was a huge painting, about 16 feet by 10 feet. And so, the guy that owned, the saloon connected to the train station there in St. Louis said, "I'll buy it." So he bought it, and he put it up on his wall, and there it hung. For a number of years, and then, of course, what happened, as happens with these particular types of establishments, it went bankrupt and went under, and one of their greatest creditors was a then small brewery in St. Louis by the name of Anheuser-Busch. And Augie Busch, never one to miss an opportunity, marched down the street, went into the saloon and said, "What are you going to do? You owe me $30,000 for all the beer." And they said, "We're bankrupt, we don't have any money." He looks up on the wall and says, "I'll take the painting." They peel the painting off the wall. He rolls it under his arm, takes it back up to the brewery, and rolls it out on a table in front of his marketing guys and says, "We're going to make prints of this painting, and we're going to send them out to everybody that sells Budweiser beer. And by the time we're done with this, we are going to be a much larger brewery than we are now." Well, boy, did it work. It worked with a vengeance. And that print is everywhere. And so it was there for a number of years, that he used it. It was kind of a perfect storm of national advertising, the Custer legend and Budweiser, all kind of, combed in together there. And so after a number of years, after they had printed off, I don't know how many at one point in time, close to 1 million of these prints a year. They had a fit of philanthropic zeal like that, and Augie Bush gave the painting to the 7th Cavalry. At that point, was based in Fort Bliss, Texas, and it hung there until 1946, when there was a fire and the commissary burned to the ground and the painting was destroyed. Or was it? The whole idea is that this painting may have survived. Look at it, and the experts that I've spoken with, they say, yeah, it's probably worth, if it did still exist, it'd be worth something like $25 to $30 million. So we had a prize MacGuffin at that point in time, and then the trick began. Well, how do we get this connected with Walt Longmire in Absaroka County? You kind of hit the nail right on the head, you know, when you made that statement, you know, because it's like, you know, it's okay to find a crime, you know, but how do you get the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state involved with this? And for me, that became Fort McKinney, which is, you know, just outside of Buffalo, which is the little town that, you know, Durant is based off of. And it's now called the Wyoming Veterans Home. And I started thinking about it and thought, well, if somebody was actually there at Fort Bliss in Texas in 1946 and he retired, like it was in the veterans home here in Wyoming, that might get Walt Longmire involved. And that's how the next to last stand became a book.
Well, and the veterans home is something that's near and dear to your heart. You've had contact with veterans there throughout the years, right?
Oh, absolutely. Look at, you know, one of the things that the old veterans do, look at, is sit out in front and, you know, weather permitting, when it's nice in the summertime, look at, they would wheelchairs out there, like, and just sit and wave, you know, at everybody. And, you know, when I was building my ranch about 20 years ago, I would stop in like that and just, you know, see what those guys had to say, like, and I'd sit on the tailgate of my truck and just talk with them and everything. And, you know, that was, you know, a period in time like that. There were still World War II veterans there at Fort McKinney. And, you know, I'd sit and talk with them, the guys from Korea, the guys from Vietnam, and it was just really wonderful stories that they had, some of which, you know, I've included in the book. And, you know, they're just a joy, like, to sit and talk with, like, and they kind of became legends, you know, they kind of become legends, you know, here around the area. They're referred to as the Waivers, is what they're referred to, like that. And I knew that Charlie Lee would probably have to be one of the Waivers.
Did you find that talking to veterans is a different type of communication that you do when, as opposed to when you are doing actual research? You can't ask pointed questions to veterans because not all of them want to talk, right?
Well, that's true. Like, but then again, it's also, you know, it's also the horse's mouth kind of a situation too. An awful lot of the time, like at, when you're talking to the, you know, the ground troop kind of guys, like at the guys who were actually there, you know, rather than, you know, watching documentaries, like at, or reading books, you know, with prepared material, and you know, you have to be careful about what you say, like that, because, you know, there's a, you know, there's a standard response, you know, to this particular question or anything like that. You know, it's always a little bit better, like at, to get the word of mouth, like that. It sometimes gives you a little bit more of an insight, which goes across, you know, the board. I mean, not only with the veterans that I talked to about Fort McKinney, but also in doing research, you know, for the Little Bighorn. I mean, that was a mountain that I was going to have to climb. You know, I always include a lot of history in my books, like that, but I'm always looking for something different, something new, like that, to include in the books. I mean, I don't want to just, you know, pour through the books and then regurgitate, you know, all the information that I found in all these stale old, you know, textbooks. And we're kind of fortunate in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, a number of really marvelous writers have taken up the mantle of historical reference. Look at, you know, Nathaniel Philbrick, James Donovan, some of the, you know, some that I'll mention now. Look at, who've written some marvelous books, you know, about the Little Bighorn that include information that, you know, up until now was not available. But then again, it was also important, I think, you know, to get the native aspect, you know, James Welch on killing Custer, and then the number of anthologies, which were oral histories from the Northern Cheyenne and the Lakota tribes, where you actually got to, you know, these were just transcribed, you know, from the stories that the veterans who actually fought in the Battle of the Little Bighorn gave out with. And, you know, what they said and what, you know, was said by, you know, the American military at that period in time were sometimes two very different stories. Look at, and that kind of, you know, set up a little bit of a, you know, an agitation, you know, of course, you know, between Walt and Henry Standing Bear, one of the other major characters in the books.
I'm chatting with Craig Johnson about his book, Next to Last Stand. It's the latest in the Walt Longmire series. The book's available now wherever books are sold. You know, Craig, you did mention a store for crappy books, and I thought about this because I'm sure you found some crappy books about the Battle of Little Bighorn when you were doing your research.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? The amount of really bad books that have been written about the Little Bighorn, actually, the only thing that rivals it is the amount of really bad movies and television shows that have been made about the Little Bighorn. There's even a scene, you know, in the book, you know, where, you know, they're sitting at the Red Pony Bar and Grill, you know, just on the map, just off the res, like, and they're watching one of these really horrible, you know, Custer films, like, and most of them don't have any kind of real, you know, connection with reality as far as what happened in the battle is concerned. But yeah, there were agendas at that period in time, like, and you know, that just, you know, goes along with any kind of, you know, major point in American history.
And I'm thinking about the research you did on Little Bighorn specifically for this book, but even for the research you do for other books, is it difficult sometimes to turn the research into art because it's not all flowery language?
Well, yeah, and then there's also that major point, you know, where you kind of have to, like, you know, drop the, you know, close the door. There was a good friend of mine, Cornelia Reed, like, who wrote a book about upstate New York. And she got really, really involved in the inland waterways of New York, you know, really got interested in it. And I think at one point in time, at the beginning of a chapter, she had a 5-page section where she talked about the inland waterways and gave it to her agent, looked at it, and the agent read it and said, okay, does somebody drown in the inland waterways? And she goes, no, it's just really interesting. She goes, you get one paragraph is what you get. There's always that point in time, you know, where you have to kind of, like, you know, kind of weigh and balance, you know, just how much information, you know, you're loading in on the reader, like that. And you know, for me, the research becomes something like what I refer to as the creek bed method of research. You know, I do a ton of research. I mean, the research on this book went on for like about 8 years before I finally sat down and wrote it. And one of the main reasons I'm aware of that is the fact that, you know, whenever the TV show Longmire was being filmed, I told the producers, you know, about this book that I had in the future, and they actually included it in one of the episodes, you know, as a subplot. And so people have asked me, they said, well, did you get the idea for this from that episode of the television series? And I'm like, no, they got their idea, you know, for me all those years ago. But the creek bed method of research, to go back to that, is that, you know, I do as much research as I can possibly do, and then whatever it is that sticks out, whatever it is that, you know, is you know, like, you know, the shiny things, you know, that are on the surface of the creek bed that I can still see within all that research, that's the things that have to be included in the book, because I think those are the things that would be interesting to the reader, you know, not just the same old stuff that they'd heard before, you know, but something new, something different that might shed, you know, a different light on the subject matter.
You probably have to come down on one side or history on another, at least on some points on the research. So how do you judge where that needle lands when you're hearing two different versions of the same story, or maybe several different versions?
You know, I try and give out that information, you know, from as many different viewpoints as I can. And that's the really wonderful thing about having an ensemble of characters, you know, because in many ways, you know, you're kind of like, you know, picking and choosing. It's kind of like conducting a choral group. You know, you have to pick and choose the voices that you're going to use. Like that. And I knew, you know, that Walt, you know, even if he didn't, you know, completely buy into everything, you know, that the historical accounts, you know, had said up to this point, he would at least, you know, give you, you know, the mainstream idea of, you know, what it is that he got from textbooks, you know, when he was in school, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And then I knew also that Henry Standing Bear would give us, you know, more of the native view, like, you know, from my good friends Marcus Red Thunder and Charles Little Old Man and a number of others from up on the res, like that are good friends, like that, you know, their view of the battle is a little bit different, you know, from ours, like that. And that's important, you know, whether it be small details like that, what actually happened, you know, to Custer's body, after the battle, like that, or, you know, to remind people that this was not a battle between two armies out on a battlefield. This was a, you know, an expenditure of, you know, of a military force chasing after, you know, a nomadic people who were basically a city, you know, on the move, like at of over, you know, 10,000 that had, you know, their loved ones with them. You know, I mean, they were there on that battlefield, you know, the Northern Cheyenne and the Lakota, you know, with their aged, with, you know, their wives, with their children and all of that. And there are two ways of looking at that. You can look at that and say, oh, well, that gave them a terrible disadvantage, you know, of having their loved ones there to know that they had to protect them and fight like that. But then again, I can't think of a more motivated fighting force, which is, you know, something that, you know, the U.S. military kind of had to come to terms with on that afternoon in 1876.
All right, just an amazing story that formed the basis for this book. The book is Next to Last Stand by Craig Johnson. It's the latest Longmire book. It's available now wherever books of any type are sold. Craig, thanks so much for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And we'll be out there looking for those crappy bookstores.
I'm right there with you. Thanks, man.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Women, he killed children, dogs, and women. But the general, he don't ride well anymore.